Welcome to OncLive On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. OncLive On Air is a podcast from OncLive, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, OncLive covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by Bristol-Myers Squibb, we had the pleasure of speaking with Hussein Borghai, DO, Chief of the Division of Thoracic Medical Oncology, Director of Lung Cancer Risk Assessment, and Associate Professor within the Department of Hematology and Oncology at Fox Chase Cancer Center, and Vijay K. Gunyuganti, MD, an adjunct faculty member in the Division of Medical Oncology at the University of Texas Health San Antonio, to discuss current frontline treatment options in advanced driver-negative non-small cell lung cancer. In our exclusive interview, Borghai and Gunyuganti discussed patient selection for frontline immunotherapy, combination immunotherapy, and chemoimmunotherapy in non-small cell lung cancer, the importance of PD-L1 expression, and emerging agents that are coming down the pike. Thank you so much for joining me, Dr. Borghai and Dr. Gunyuganti, for an episode of OncLive On Air to discuss the use of immunotherapy in advanced non-small cell lung cancer. Nice to have you both.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here with you.
What are the current treatment options that are available to patients with metastatic driver-negative non-small cell lung cancer in the first-line setting?
We actually now have a number of different options for the treatment of patients with a driver-negative non-small cell lung cancer, regardless of histology. There is, first of all, a differentiation as far as I am concerned, based on a PD-L1 status. What I mean by that is that in my view, if somebody has a PD-L1 that's considered to be high and that is greater than 50% TPS, I think single agent immunotherapy with either pembrolizumab or now have approval for atezolizumab would be an appropriate option for some of our patients. Clearly for patients who have a PD-L1 less than 50%, combination of chemotherapy plus a checkpoint inhibitor has shown significant clinical activity and efficacy. And again, this is regardless of histology. And so in a simplified manner, based on the PD-L1, those two options are something that we've had access to for some time now. More recently, we've had the approval of a combination of ipilimumab and nivolumab as a sort of what is labeled as chemo-free regimen with two checkpoint inhibitors approved by the FDA for patients with PD-L1 over 1% TPS, which provides yet another option for some of our patients. And then to expand on that, we also have regulatory approval for what is now commonly called the 9LA regimen, which is basically the CheckMate 227, which is ipi-nivo, but with an abbreviated course of chemo. And by that, I mean only two cycles of chemotherapy. Again, histology-driven platinum doublet, but only for two cycles. The dosing of the nivolumab is a little bit different in the 9LA than it is in the CheckMate 227. But nonetheless, we have a variety of options for our patients at this point. And really, the physicians and the patients can discuss the pros and cons of these approaches and decide which one they would like to proceed with. Of course, this gets to be a little bit more nuanced, but I'm going to wait a little bit and maybe we can come back to some of these nuances later on.
Dr. Gunyuganti, would you say that PD-L1 expression carries that much weight for treatment selection beyond the greater than or equal to 50% and less than 50% cutoffs?
Oh, great question. So PD-L1 expression in lung cancer, I mainly look at more than 50% because if I have a patient with a performance status which is not good to tolerate chemotherapy, first thing I'm looking at is this patient eligible for single agent immunotherapy? Because as you know, there are several patients who present with stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer, specifically driver negative patients. Most of them are eligible for chemotherapy as well, but not all. So we see around 1/3 or more patients who may not be able to tolerate and have a performance status of 1 to 2 where giving chemotherapy may not be appropriate. In those patients, I believe PD-L1 expression more than 50% makes a lot of sense. But in terms of less than 1% and 1%, as you can see in the 9LA study and CheckMate 227, One study showed there's no difference if the PD-L1 expression is more than 1% versus less, and the other trial showed if it is, you know, they stratified it, but there was no big difference in the response rates.
And Dr. Borghi, how are you using PD-L1 expression to guide your treatment decisions?
So once we go through the molecular testing and we've determined that someone definitely doesn't have an actionable mutation or a driver mutation, so to speak, or alteration, then I look at PD-L1. For patients with PD-L1 over 50%, in the absence of significant clinical signs and symptoms related to the disease, meaning significant weight loss, a lot of cough, a huge disease burden that I think it's causing problems, then my preference is to start with single agent immunotherapy. And again, in that category, pembrolizumab has been my go-to drug just because it was first approved and we are familiar with it and all of that. And really nothing a lot more than that. But if a patient is very symptomatic, again, then my preference is to use chemo plus immunotherapy. For patients that have PD-L1 less than 50%, then the discussion becomes a little bit more involved in that we have chemo plus a checkpoint inhibitor, which is, again, something that we've had around for quite some time, reasonably well-tolerated regimen, although, unfortunately, there are always side effects that one has to be aware of in any cancer therapy. And, you know, chemo plus immunotherapy is no exception. So that's one discussion. If a patient, for whatever reason, it could be a number of different reasons, are not possibly good candidates for chemotherapy, or if a patient really expresses this desire to stay away from chemo, and again, here I think a little bit of patient education is important. A lot of patients are afraid of the term chemotherapy because they have seen maybe older family members or somebody who got treated several years ago, different types of malignancies, and they've had a lot of side effects from chemotherapy. So I think for those reasons, some of our patients come in and sort of are asking if they can be treated without chemo. And I think, again, that becomes a discussion between the patient and the physician to come up with the best possible approach, you know, keeping patients' desires and everything else in mind. So chemo plus immunotherapy becomes one option for PD-L1 less than 50%. If the PD-L1 is 1% or better, then the IO-IO regimen with ipi/nivo does become, again, an option for discussion. Now, I don't have a biomarker or a specific algorithm that I can tell you I use to decide somebody's going to get ipi/nivo versus chemo-IO. I can tell you that it is a discussion between me and the patient and sort of thinking about the side effect profile and whether there's an advantage to getting chemo right away or not. And that becomes a shared decision-making process, basically, given as much information as I can possibly give to a patient. And then we decide from there. Now, the 9LA regimen is interesting because technically it's approved for anyone, as you just heard from Dr. Gandhi, regardless of the PD-L1 status. So if somebody does not have a PD-L1 expression, then an abbreviated course of chemo with an ipi/nivo regimen does become a potential option. And again, there is no specific criteria that I can sort of outline that specifically tells you or tells the how to choose between one regimen. There's definitely a certain comfort level that you have to have with an ipi/nivo combination. We know that ipilimumab, the addition of ipilimumab, can increase some toxicities, especially colitis. So therefore, a good patient education, making sure that all the side effects are discussed, making sure that the patient is aware to call immediately at the first sign of any kind of side effect, becomes really important. But that's also important for people who are on chemo plus immunotherapy because some of the side effects can happen. So the discussion and a patient education component of it actually is fairly equal between all of these regimens as far as I'm concerned. So short of, you know, a specific biomarker that tells us someone is going to do better with ipi/nivo versus chemo-IO becomes a personal preference with the patient. And also to some extent, and, you know, again, I've been very open about this, the bias of the clinician. I am biased towards an ipi/nivo regimen. I've always liked that a little bit better. I participated in CheckMate 227. I've been a member of the steering committee. So I know that I'm coming into this with that level of bias towards an IO-IO regimen. But at the same time, as a physician, I look at the data and quite clearly, chemo plus immunotherapy is a very good regimen for many of our patients. So again, the thing that I have to emphasize is this is an area where we have a lot of different options. Discussing it with the patient and sort of taking into account some of their preferences become really important and gives us an option to have more than just one treatment for any given patient.
Now, let's say a patient is eligible for chemoimmunotherapy and that dual immunotherapy combination. For you, does it come down to whether a patient needs a fast response, perhaps recommending something with chemotherapy versus if a patient is more interested in the durability of that response that would sway you towards an immunotherapy doublet?
When it comes to, you know, we have two regimens right now for first line. You have chemoimmunotherapy and a double IO chemotherapy immunotherapy with small dose of shorter duration chemotherapy. So when the patients come to me, I'm looking at them, as I first alluded, look at the performance status and also the symptoms, as Dr. Borge said. And we look at, is the patient suffering from disease, cancer-related side effects or symptoms, or is it due to their comorbid conditions like COPD, bad emphysema, on oxygen or not on oxygen? So I tend to divide those patients and then have a honest discussion with the patient. So we have two regimens. One is pure immunotherapy combination, and other one is chemoimmunotherapy. So like Dr. Borges said, I like the non-chemo option because I look at my patients and say, is this patient going to tolerate, you know, carboplatin, AUC5, and pemetrexed 500 milligrams per meter square, because immunotherapy does not have too many side effects with single agent. So when I say, okay, this patient can tolerate, then I present them with the data and say, this is one of the regimens. And then about combination, IO-IO combination, which also I like. If you look at the CheckMate 227, after 3 years, it's showing such a robust data that compels me also to present that. And if I have a patient who I'm debating whether to give IO-IO or chemoimmunotherapy, then if the patient has comorbid conditions or disease-related symptoms, I go with immunotherapy combination.
It is true that durability of responses at Ipi-Nivo is really good, and I like that, and that's fine. But it is not like there's a choice within durability versus getting early control, the way the question was originally framed. I think there is definitely a role for cytotoxic chemotherapy in some patients, meaning that you can get a more rapid response when you have chemotherapy on board. So there's no, I don't think I can question the data that we've seen in terms of the progression of some of our patients without a chemo regimen. Durability with Ipi-Nivo has always been pretty impressive, and I like that data. And again, as I pointed out, and I keep bringing this up because I think it's important to be transparent about all of this, I've been part of those studies, and I do like the durability of Ipi-Nivo. But it is not like the chemo IO does not have durability to it, right? So, and you know, in the absence of a randomized study head-to-head, it's kind of hard to sort of say durability of one is significantly better than the other. I think we have to be a little bit careful. Everything is subject to interpretation and a little bit of a, you know, personal view of how you look at the data. But I think the key thing is, again, as you just heard from Dr. Gunthi, sometimes we choose a specific regimen and we have a preference for one and we talk to our patients about it. But I think it is important to have a clear discussion about all the possible options and sort of decide what would be the best treatment option for patients.
And in May of 2020, we had an additional option brought to the table in the 9LA regimen. Has that regimen kind of combined the best of both worlds with immunotherapy and chemotherapy? How have you really incorporated it into your practice?
So the best of both worlds is a big phrase for, you know, a regimen like this. I like the data, definitely. If chemotherapy is good and if chemotherapy can help sort of avoid early progression, then a couple of cycles of it should be enough to get the immune system going, prevent early progression, and sort of go on with an IO-IO regimen. I think the issue with 9LA is that the follow-up has been very short. Keep in mind that we've only seen one brief presentation on that. We don't have, you know, all the data. What we've seen so far looks really promising and it looks good. But again, whether that is the regimen to go forward, we don't know. For instance, the control arm of 9LA was just chemotherapy, not chemo-IO. So do we know that, you know, that is definitely the best of both worlds right now? Or if we do a randomized study, is it pretty much going to be equal? So we don't know that information. But at least from a theoretical point of view and based on, again, limited data that we've seen from 9LA, It is an interesting combination. Again, gives you the chemo to avoid early progression. Hopefully, if you believe the theory, cause a little bit of a cancer cell death, a bit more immunogenic, and then you bring in Ipi/Nivo, and therefore you could have a more durable and sustained responses. So we have to wait and see more data and more follow-up to sort of decide if that is definitely, you know, the best of both worlds kind of a regimen for us.
I did want to go a little further into the data of the CheckMate 9LA regimen, even though it's still relatively early in follow-up. When you first saw the presentation, what was the most compelling to you?
Basically, when I look at the 9LA study, the one-year data is very, very compelling to me, because when we were in training or a few, you know, almost even 5 to 10 years ago, the chemo itself was only helping one-third of the patients. Now we have almost 60 to 70% of the patients are getting benefit in the first 1 year itself and making them live longer.
Yeah, so I think the 9LA is definitely interesting. I agree with what was said. I think the compelling data there was that, you know, regardless of the level of PD-L1, there seemed to be an overall survival advantage with the two short courses of chemo plus Ipi/Nivo, which again, makes it interesting and provides a little bit more option for patients. At the same time, you know, it doesn't provide as much of a personalization that we like to provide for our patients. But nonetheless, it's a treatment option that I think can be offered to most of the patients when we see, again, given the combination with Ipi/Nivo, as long as they don't have any contraindications and all of that. So the PD-L1 agnostic kind of survival advantage that we saw, I think, was interesting.
I totally agree with Dr. Borges said. And we have, if you look at, you know, the CheckMate 227 and 9LA, and 9LA uses a shorter duration of chemotherapy. So the advantage of that regimen is you're trying to give short course of chemotherapy to work better with immunotherapy. And then the secondary gain I'm getting is I'm testing if this patient will how does this patient tolerate chemotherapy when I do that, although it's a short duration. And if you come to CheckMate 227, and it's a non-chemo option. So before this regimen was approved, what do I used to do? You know, the patient is eligible, not eligible for chemo. And I'm always thinking with the Keynote 189, like, as this patient can tolerate pemetrexed and carbo or cis? Because that's a very important question to answer, because we now know that in studies which have shown phase, you know, Hoffman status more than 2, palliative care is better than giving chemotherapy. So there's some truth to that big study which was published a few years ago. Now we have a IO-IO combination, which is a non-chemo option, which is very appealing and also showed robust data. Henceforth, I am now using more of this regimen in my patients.
And since the approval of nivolumab and ipilimumab also in May of this year, what sort of toxicities should we be aware of with regard to the purely immunotherapy regimens?
I can probably say more because I have several patients I've treated with this regimen, and I do treat with dual IO combination in other cancer settings, namely renal and melanoma. One has to keep in mind that the lung cancer patients are a different set of patients. They may, so I want you to be all be diligent about when you start the IO-IO on a patient with lung cancer. It's not, steroid can cause side effects, so we always worry about that. So I'm seeing few more immune-mediated related side effects, which you can manage them. It's not like chemo, we have to wait for the time, but I would be very cognizant and keep a very close eye in the first 2 cycles of dual IO combination regimen to make sure that they're tolerating it well.
And Dr. Borg, how have you incorporated that regimen into your practice?
So as a group here at Fox Chase, we decided that we like the data that we've seen with CheckMate 227 and PD-L1 negative tumors, actually. Even though the approval is not necessarily in the PD-L1 negative subgroup of patients, we kind of decided as a group that preferentially that's the regimen we're going to be using in PD-L1 negative subpopulation. there's been discussions that maybe that should be, that's particularly good for patients with squamous histology or not. I'm not sure I'm on board necessarily with all of that at this point. But again, right now the PD-L1 negative group is where we almost preferentially want to use that. Again, appropriate patient population, good performance status and all of that are the caveats that, again, we have to keep in mind.
Is there anything that we failed to cover regarding treatment selection between immunotherapy, combination immunotherapy, and chemoimmunotherapy?
As I alluded before, we take into several factors when we are trying to figure out whether a single agent immunotherapy versus combination immunotherapy versus chemoimmunotherapy. And we have more tools and ammunition right now and more regimens to treat our lung cancer patient. This is much, much better than what we were before. So things which we have not covered, I think we covered most of them. Look at the toxicity of the patient, for the patient, tolerability of the patient, and the cost, and all these needs to be kept in mind when you are deciding one of the three options.
So turning specifically to the adjuvant setting now, are there any additional patient and or disease-specific characteristics that have to be taken into account for treatment in that setting?
To me, this is a little bit more controversial because, first of all, we don't have a lot of data on IO in the adjuvant setting yet. A couple of studies have completed accrual, but we haven't had data. We do know that patients in the adjuvant setting, if they meet the standard criteria, would benefit from standard four cycles of platinum chemotherapy. But whether the addition of IO to this group is going to be associated with better outcomes, we still don't know. We're waiting for the results of the study. The targeted therapy, again, to me, this, and I'm curious to see what Dr. Ganti thinks about this one, this is an area that is rapidly changing. So I think the most important data that I have seen is what was presented most recently on the ADORA study, which was 3 years of osimertinib and patients post-resection with an EGFR mutation positive tumor. And the result of that study, as presented and published and all that, suggested that disease-free survival was significantly better, and I mean significantly better, for the group that received osimertinib. There have been a lot of discussions back and forth about whether that represents a new standard of care or not, because we don't have overall survival information yet. Some of our colleagues have been discussing that is the most important component of treatment for somebody who has had basically curative intent treatment, which is surgery followed by chemotherapy. But looking at the disease-free survival curves, I think it's important to keep in mind that the magnitude of benefit is so much in favor of using osimertinib in that particular patient population that it's going to be hard to sort of not offer that as a subsequent therapy. In the U.S., of course, our standard has always been to do four cycles of chemo and then go into the adjuvant setting. That's not exactly how the study was done in ADORA, but we do have a subgroup analysis from that study suggesting that regardless of whether patients got adjuvant chemo or not, the disease-free survival was in favor of osimertinib. So, that can be discussed further if needed. So at this point, I would say if we have regulatory approval for the use of the agent in the adjuvant setting, I will definitely discuss it with my patients and, offer it. But I do agree that in a curative intent setting, having overall survival is important and should be considered. And then come into this whole discussion, of course, comes the issue with the brain metastases and control of brain metastases with osimertinib, which again, to me, just adds to the value of this particular intervention. So I think there's a lot that's going on, and hopefully we get more data and more clarity as the years go on and as we continue to discuss and get more information from ADORO and some of the other studies.
I agree with Dr. Borge. We look at the adjuvant setting. One of the best data is using, huge unmet need was in the patient who are EGFR positive patients who get resected. We were not doing much so until this trial came up, and with a better CNS penetration and showing improvement in survival of the patient. I would definitely was excited to see the data. And in the community oncology also, we still think the stage three after chemo radiation can be like a adjuvant setting. So IO has been approved, durvalumab, for 1 year after chemo radiation. And that has also shown to be a big unmet need was filled for patients who were not having good survival in spite of chemoradiation in the past. So that also is a bigger impact on lung cancer survival.
So in terms of what's coming down the pipe, Dr. Borghi, you mentioned some immunotherapy studies in the adjuvant setting. Could you elaborate on what some of those are?
Under that category, I think the big one is the ANVIL arm of the ALCHEMIST study is something that have completed the accrual and we're waiting for the results of that. We also know that in the neoadjuvant setting, we have had a lot of efforts moving immunotherapy even to an earlier stage. So these are patients who are getting some form of immunotherapy, either with chemo or without, before they go to surgery. And we have a press release from a study suggesting that the primary endpoint of one of the studies has been met. But that is another area that I think we're very, very interested in seeing what the results of the studies are, because, again, if we can cure more patients with this disease, and that can happen at an earlier stage, I think that is where the majority of the benefit is going to come. So we are very curious and sort of interested in seeing what the results of these neoadjuvant trials are. And there's a whole bunch of them that hopefully will be reported out soon. So there's a lot to be enthusiastic about in the adjuvant, neoadjuvant setting, again, because it is a curative intent population of our patients. On the metastatic side, again, things are not staying dormant, thankfully. We're very happy to see several studies that are ongoing, and these are, phase three type of studies for patients who have had evidence of disease progression after receiving chemotherapy and immunotherapy. So there are several trials under that category that are ongoing. There is excitement about a phase two study that was presented using a different immunotherapy approach, just find a TIGIT antibody plus atezolizumab. So again, we're interested in hopefully seeing some data on that in coming years. Again, trying to improve and move the needle even in the metastatic setting to see if we can potentially improve on the clinical outcome and overall survival of patients with this disease. So it's a very active area. I don't think we have enough time to go through all of the studies that are ongoing that look very promising and nice and good. But I think it just tells me that the momentum that we've gained with immunotherapy and with the targeted therapies is continuing. We're learning a little bit more. We're moving these agents who are, that are very, very active in an earlier stage of the disease to maximize their benefit. So it all looks like positive improvement and positive steps that the community is taking. So personally, I'm very excited about what the future is going to hold for our patients and for the improvement that we see and outcomes.
Yeah, definitely agree. And I think coming down the pike, what's coming up, so I definitely want to look at more targeted therapies. I think we are having more mutations being found. We now have 8 NCCN guideline recommended mutations have to be checked in lung cancer, and there are more to come. And just now found an ERBB2 mutation, a couple of patients. There's some promising results in the early trials. And a lot of times in lung cancer, we think, okay, let's try immunotherapy in all of them. But now we have 2 mutations which tell us if there's resistance pathway or to the resistance to the immunotherapy. So I'm more curious to find in future, resistance pathways and newer targeted therapies and more IO combinations where we can treat the patients without or getting away from chemotherapy.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air, sponsored by Bristol-Myers Squibb. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science summits and institutional perspectives in cancer webinars. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.